Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our dive into the news, which we do every couple of weeks. And with me today is Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds.
Hello,
Adrian.
Hi.
And John Stevens, our National Director.
Hi, Phil.
Hello, John. Good to see you. We talked a couple of weeks ago at length about where the government was at following the mini-budget. I just want to start there again this week. So at the time of recording, rumours that there might be further U-turns, the pound has bounced a little bit, but it does seem as though the Prime Minister is sticking to her guns in terms of the tax cuts that have been announced, and still we
most
seem to be
them.
Most of them. So one of them has been turned back on, hasn't it, since we recorded last? I think it's the 45p tax rate. How do we respond to this ongoing turmoil, especially I'm thinking particularly about folk in our churches who are bluntly worried, John?
Well, I think at one level, we don't know what's going to happen. Even today, there's uncertainty. So yesterday in PMQ, the Prime Minister was saying that they're not going to cut any public spending at all. And people have said, can she really mean that, given the kind of report that's going to come from the OBR and the pressure in markets? Today, there's been sort of suggestions that there's going to be a U-turn on the mini budget on things like corporation tax. She's denied it. Downing Street seems to have suggested that maybe there are people having those conversations. So I think we're in a field of total uncertainty at the moment. Mm. What's obvious is there's been chaos within the financial markets. Some of the proposals have been badly received. Government seems to have to be responding to that. So I think one of the pastoral challenges at the moment is we don't know where this is going to land. So the Bank of England has taken action to protect pension funds. It looks as though benefits are going to rise with the rate of inflation. So the political reality is forcing government to adopt measures that are less likely to precipitate kind of greater problems in the cost of living crisis. And of course, political reality is the government is now deeply unpopular. So I think one of the pastoral challenges, we simply don't know what's going to happen at this point. And therefore, I think we have to encourage people to do what the Bible says, which is not be anxious, not worry, worry about today, not worry about the future, trust in the Lord Jesus and his promises to provide. Because honestly, we don't have the answers to exactly how it's going to sort of turn out. And we're all impacted. This week, I got notification, my energy bills are going to go up from the 5th of November by about 1,500 quid, even with the government proposals there. You suddenly realise that it doesn't actually particularly protect you. So the reality is people are being hit. Others are looking to renew mortgages, mortgages coming to an end of fixed terms. That's going to significantly impact people. So there are some things where you can begin to see this. People are going to be suffering financially, and we need to be making sure that we are looking out for those for whom this is going to be impossible to bear. But in the broader picture, I think at this point, actually, we just need to encourage people to put their trust in God, because we actually don't know exactly where this is going to end.
I think as a church member, I just feel emotionally drained at the moment. We've gone through COVID and all that went with that, and the lockdowns and the difficulties there. We've gone through the war in Ukraine. We've got a cost of living crisis. I feel like I've gone from worrying about my energy bills to worrying about my mortgage, worrying about my pension. It just feels emotionally draining. Is that fair, Adrian?
I think it is, but I think it's in part because we are living in historically unusual times generally in the 21st century. So most of the time we live with certainty. We know what we're going to be paid. We know what our benefits are going to be. We know what is coming in each month. We've got a fairly good idea what's going out each month. And I think what COVID did is it undid that certainty. Mm. And it's interesting that people want to fix problems that they have by introducing certainty. They want to know, what am I going to do about this? How am I going to cope with this? Who's going to pay this bill? Who's going to pay that bill? But actually, around the world today, most Christians live with uncertainty numerically. And across history, most Christians have lived with uncertainty. And it seems to me that when you read the pages of the New Testament especially, most Bible Christians live with uncertainty. Paul is very uncertain. I've just been reading through 2 Corinthians as a staff team, and he talks about, you know, it being better to be with the Lord, but I don't know whether I'm going to be with the Lord or not. I don't know. And I think rather than saying to people, you know, we could do this for you as a church, we could do that for you as a church. Now, those things are important. I think as pastors and preachers, we've got to help people know that the Bible and the Spirit of God equips us to live with deep uncertainty in this world. I mean, frankly, the uncertainty we're facing is much deeper than it has been for many people in the past, but it's nothing compared to the uncertainty that people around the world live with. So I think we've got to say to people, no, this is the normal Christian life. And actually, the Spirit of the living God equips us to live as Christians in this normal life.
And I think it's worth recognizing there's a danger of catastrophizing circumstances. So I mean, we have the news constantly presenting this to us. But actually, the reality is, for example, wholesale gas prices are dropping rapidly because world supply is adjusting to changed circumstances. There's every indication that that may well be much better in six months' time. The Russians are being driven out of parts of Ukraine, and you know, you can see senses in which that conflict seems to be potentially drawing towards some kind of a conclusion over time. The markets are forcing government to moderate their positions in a way that means that people are better protected. So I think there is a danger of blowing some of these things out of proportion and taking a very short-term view. And I was reading an article today that said that, you know, there are much bigger problems in the world. You know, 345 million people are in danger of starvation.
Yeah.
And we have to have a measure of perspective, yeah, not catastrophize everything. And not everything is the imminent arrival of the apocalypse. So some balanced perspective, I think, is really helpful.
That's really helpful advice. Thank you. I hope that's helpful to church leaders as well as they listen this week. Can I stay with government for a minute? There was a question asked in Parliament yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions about the transgender charity Mermaids, essentially saying they should face a police investigation. There seems to be a whole lot of criticism being levelled at that, but not from the church, which has always criticised the charity for its position on these matters, but actually from the world. It seems like the ideology is increasingly being challenged. Have I read too much into that?
No, I don't think so. And in this case, it's not just the ideology; it's the practice behind the ideology. So, whether you send chest binders to underage girls, for example. So there are. It's not just the ideology, I think, which is up for debate. Although it is, the ideology is being debated. It is the practice that sometimes. Counter to what Mermaids seem to have been saying in public is going on.
I think that's right. I mean, Mermaids have presented themselves as a caring organisation that's helping children struggling with issues of transgender, that helps parents where their kids are struggling with those issues. They've been hugely influential in providing advice to schools and organisations. They provided advice to the Church of England and have shaped transgender policy. And just things have come out about the way that they're behaving that are deeply disturbing. So a series of scandals, the kind of breast binding, kind of workshops enabling kids to do DIY hormone therapy. One of their trustees has recently resigned because it was sort of revealed that he'd spoken at a conference a few years ago that was about sort of protecting and helping paedophiles, and he'd made comments about sex with children isn't really the problem. One of their workers has been exposed as sort of dressing up as a schoolgirl and posting explicit photos of themselves online. So this organization that's presented itself as the caring face of dealing with children struggling with transgender and gender issues, which is a real issue in our society at the moment because of a complete lack of clarity about what gender identity ought to be. Actually, behind the scenes, you discover some radical activists who are pushing in an agenda that the vast majority of parents and members of society would consider as entirely unacceptable. So I think the face is being removed, and a reality of the intentions of activists behind the scenes is being kind of revealed, and quite rightly, the Charity Commission is investigating. Liz Truss supported some kind of investigation into that. And I think it's a good thing that the motivations of those who've been pushing a particular ideology have finally been exposed. And it's not surprising that that calls into question the ideology itself. And there seems to be an agenda here on the part of some to want to undermine what most people regard as common sense, which is your gender has to be in line with your biological sort of sex. And I think there are increasing voices from a wide range of people saying that the transgender ideology has been carried too far. We've seen that coming from J.K. Rowling, and there's been increasing support for her position. I think the advice given to schools and organisations is now questioned. We've seen the Tavistock Clinic closed.
There's been a large-scale withdrawal, hasn't there, from Stonewall's employment schemes. That's all part of the same narrative.
And I think an increasing number of people, particularly teenage girls, looking back saying we were wrongly treated, we've been harmed by being put on these kind of puberty blockers and a track towards transgender sort of surgery, and a recognition that some of this gender confusion is just the normal result of puberty that's being capitalised on by people with an agenda. So this is one of those instances in which the the culture seems to be coming in line with what most of the churches have held to, which is not that surprising, given that we believe in creation and a common grace, which is true for everyone.
Pastorally, how do we help churches? I mean, there will be people in our churches, children perhaps suffering with gender dysphoria. That's a real thing. Pastorally, how do we help families in the local church when these issues present themselves?
Goodness, that's a whole podcast.
It's a whole podcast, I'm sorry, yeah. But it seems like a relevant question.
It's some of the things we've said before, actually. Each case needs to be thought about on its own merit. It's very difficult to draw general lines and general rules. I think on the whole, we've got to be extraordinarily kind and compassionate and also patient, actually, as people work through things. And a situation, for example, in a family where a teenage child is professing to be a Christian might be very different from a situation where a teenage child is not professing to be a Christian, but the parents are. So, or the age of the child. So I think every situation is very different. There are some good resources around. We'll put some in the show notes. I think I'm cautious about making blanket statements from the pulpit. I think that's not always helpful if you know there are situations like this going on in church. I think we've also got to be careful that if we as leaders in church are taking a careful, thoughtful, prayerful approach with people who are struggling in church, we've got to make sure that's not undermined by other church members. So I think one of the things that sometimes happens in church is that you decide as a group of leaders, we're going to take approach A to this situation, and then someone else in church goes up to the family and says, well, of course you should be, and then actually all the work is undone. People are often ostracized. So I think actually some of it is about leading the church through how you respond and not just thinking, how do we as pastors, as elders, respond to a situation?
I think we need to sort of empathize with those that are genuinely struggling, not dismiss that. It is real. The probability is it's a very small percentage. Interestingly, the Stonewall research that they did into LGBTQ in the UK today identified only 1% of people, or less than 1%, as identifying as trans or sort of non-binary. So we need to recognize this is a very small phenomena kind of in reality. And I think often for parents, if they're confronted that with a teenage child, a child who's kind of going through adolescence and puberty, I think a patience, a kind of an empathy with what the child is struggling with. But actually the evidence suggests that in many cases, people will grow through the confusion of adolescence. It raises all sorts of gender identity issues and other identity issues. But in many cases, those will over time resolve themselves. And I think that sort of government advice, which is not to treat, not to sort of encourage people to transition until they have gone beyond the age of 18, is actually helpful in that regard. And I think the danger for Christian parents is to want it to be resolved now, rather than maybe exercising a high degree of patience, prayer, a love for their kids. And in many cases, what presents as a teenage problem may well have dissipated later in life. And I think sometimes Christian parents are too quick to want to sort it out now because they want to feel the comfort of that. And that can actually be counterproductive.
Wise words. Thank you both. I want to cross the pond, if I may, to the States. I want to talk about some research that's come out from Ligonier and Lifeway, to Christian organizations in the States. And this is what they call their State of Theology survey. Now, it is related to America, so I'm not for a minute suggesting these figures would translate to the British scene, but I do think it's interesting. So essentially, 53% of those they spoke to say the Bible has helpful accounts, but is not literally true. 48% say God can change and adapt. Both of these completely contrary to what the Bible actually teaches. Often these folk getting the label evangelical when they respond to these surveys. It's fascinating, really. What lessons can we draw for kind of Bible teaching, the whole counsel of God? What can churches over here take from that kind of
research?
I'm going
to let John go first, because I may be more cynical about this survey than him. I don't know, but I'll let him go first and I'll chuck in.
I think the survey is an attempt to kind of demonstrate that in the evangelical church, there isn't as firm a commitment to the Bible and to historic doctrine as we might like to think.
In the States.
But I think that's probably true in the UK as well, maybe not to the same degree. We don't have so much of a hinterland of cultural evangelicalism as they do in the States. But in many churches, people are not particularly doctrinally thought through. I think the challenge is that some of the questions, what exactly do they mean? So take that question about whether you believe the Bible is literally true. Take, for example, the issue of creation. Now, does that mean that you have to read Genesis as being a literal description of a sort of a six day kind of creation. If that's what literal means, there'll be a whole load of people who we would recognise as solidly Bible-believing evangelicals who would regard the account in Genesis as being in some way symbolic or typical, and would read it in a slightly different way, who probably wouldn't want to agree with the statement that the Bible is literally true. They might agree that it is true, but the form of the genre doesn't mean that literalism is exactly the way that it speaks. So a question like that, the bare answer doesn't actually tell you necessarily what you need to know. The same is in relation to a question like, does God change? I think for lots of Christians, if you ask them, does God change? They're not really thinking about the immutability of God and what that means. They're thinking about a prayer, how God interacts. They read the Bible and they see God relationally interacting with people. Actually, the doctrine of the immutability of God and what it means for God not to change and yet relate to a changing world is actually theologically rather complex. So I think I want to be slightly cautious about drawing too much from the particular questions, because the way you ask it kind of dictates an answer and is already making a decision as to exactly which part of the evangelical spectrum you think people ought to be on. But the bigger point, that there are a large number of people who don't properly understand biblical doctrine, aren't being taught appropriately, is one that we need to take on board, because it's the key task of church leaders to be discipling people so they know God better and they understand his word better.
And I've had patience. We said we needed patience, so I've had patience in responding, and now I'm going to be more restrained than I would have been. First of all, I think the lines are drawn so broadly in the States with the term evangelical. So of those who are self-identify as evangelical and then say, you know, do they believe that Jesus died for sins? It's a reasonably low proportion, which I think most evangelicals in the UK would claim as a truth. So yeah. So I think this survey from our point of view, apart from in very, very general ways, is undermined. But it does make me think about a couple of things. One is, I'm very grateful in the FIEC that we ask people to recommit to the basis of faith every year. Mm. I think that's a great way, actually, of challenging doctrinal drift. We're actually actively asking people to sign up. And if you're if the pastor's network, if you're a member church, you think, oh, why? Every year this comes around, I have to sign my form. Actually, that's really important to commit to the doctrines that we hold as firm and truthful and important. And actually, I think you can't quite do that in church in the same way. You can't ask people to sign up for membership, I don't think, every year in quite the same way. But actually, how we teach our basis of faith in church is really important. Mm. So how we teach new members what we believe as a church, you know, every now and again, perhaps we do need to work through our basis of faith as a preaching series. I think actually making sure that the things we say we believe as a church, we actually do believe, is really, really essential. And I think there's a place in church life for going over those things.
Is that done in the regular Sunday sermon, or is that something different, or is it both and?
Well, I don't think the regular Sunday sermon can do all of those things. I think actually one of our problems in our church life is thinking the Sunday sermon is everything. Mm. And the Sunday sermon is meant to be a mix of spiritual encouragement, exhortation, teaching. But it seems to me we don't sufficiently separate out the different biblical categories of preaching, prophecy, teaching. And actually, as Christians to grow, we need a diet of all of those. We need some elements of systematic, a kind of doctrinal instruction. And I think a number of churches are experimenting with things like, in the UK, the equivalent of American adult Sunday school groups, or kind of more seminar format or more lecture format to fill them in. And I think we increasingly need to do that. And we shouldn't think that the expository sermon on a Sunday is going to provide people with everything that they need to grow in faith. If I could just comment on a couple of the things in the survey. I mean, I talked about doctrines which are perhaps a bit more complicated, or on which evangelicals might nuance them and speak of them in different ways. There are some that I think are troubling, because you would have thought that evangelicals would be clear on sort of these issues. So I think for me, the troubling ones are the percentage of people who think that people are born innocent and don't really believe that in original sin, which was about 65% of professing evangelicals. I think that the number who believe that gender identity is a matter of personal choice, I think it was 37% who said that. The number of evangelicals who said that the Bible's teaching on homosexuality was no longer relevant today, which was something like 28%. Now, I think those are ways in which you can see that evangelicalism has been taken in by the wider culture. And they're not doctrines that are particularly complex, difficult, sort of systematic doctrines that you would expect people to perhaps have some difficulty understanding. And I think it really is just a warning to us that in those areas, there is a great danger of significant drift.
I want to stay in the States and talk about Alex Jones.
You've
probably come across this guy. So he is a radio presenter in the States. He put forth a conspiracy theory about the awful tragedy at Sandy Hook with the school shootings. And I believe in this last couple of days has been asked to pay $965 million to the families at Sandy Hook.
Second case is lost.
Is that right? Yeah. I just think there's some lessons for us here, I think, about conspiracy theories, about how quickly they can grow, how people can be drawn into them. What's your response to it, John?
Well, I mean, I think at one level, I'm delighted that he's been called out for his lies, for his deception. He earns a vast amount of money from peddling things that are untrue to an audience that wants to believe it and wants to hear it.
It's interesting, isn't it? They call it fake news rather than lies. But it is lies, isn't it?
It is lies.
Yeah.
You know, how could anybody, in the light of the evidence, possibly believe that the Sandy Hook murders were fake, that it was actors? That's bound up with the gun lobby. It's bound up with an anti-federal government approach. And I think it is good that he has been called to account for basically shedding sort of this kind of opinion out there and encouraging people to believe it and causing immense hurt to the people who have suffered in that situation. So I think absolutely right that he is called to account. I mean, the figures of the damages are ridiculous, but that's American jury orientated damages situations. But to effectively have to pay £1 billion or $1 billion is
about the same now, John, with the...
well, it may well be parity. Yeah. So, but I think we live in a world in which there are these social media figures and even some politicians who basically peddle what are essentially utterly unsubstantiated conspiracy theorists. And it reminds us that there are liars out there. The Bible would say that in the church, they're false teachers. There are people who deliberately peddle these things. Alex Jones is immensely wealthy because people give him money for this stuff.
He flew to the trial in a private jet and rented a villa with a pool. I mean, it's just, wow. it's obscene, really.
So the lying conspiracy theorists. And then there's the why do gullible and naive people want to believe it? And it seems to me that it's a reminder to us that there are lots of people who will believe what they want to believe, even in the face of the evidence. Mm. And actually, that's quite helpful to us as Christians, as we think about the whole task of evangelism and sharing the gospel. We can mistakenly think that people are somehow neutral and objective and are going to judge the evidence on the basis of, you know, whether it stacks up or not. There's a whole load of people who will believe what they want to believe.
David Aronovich has written a book. He's a Times journalist, comes from a Jewish background, not a Christian, and he's written a book on conspiracy theories, starting with The Elder, the Sons of Zion. Have I got that right? Is that the right phrase? Beginning at the 20th century and going through conspiracy theories, you know, who shot JFK, you know, how did the Twin Towers come down, what happened to Diana, you know, all these sorts of things, and demonstrating, he debunks all these conspiracy theories. Then a very interesting chapter at the end, why do people believe in conspiracy theories?
What does he say?
And it's exactly what John is saying, that people already have a narrative. They already have a formed motive and an idea of what's going on in the world. And they're just looking for stories to reinforce it.
And that probably fits helpfully with our own evangelism, doesn't it, really, in terms of us sharing the gospel with people. People, as John says, will already have their own narratives about how to respond to that and often do so negatively. There's been the evangelism conferences that have happened this last couple of weeks. Yep. Adrian, just tell us a bit about those.
So I've been on the road with the evangelism conferences, four of those, with Randy Newman, who is himself a Jewish background believer. He works at the C.S. Lewis Institute in Washington. He's just written a book, actually, called Mere Evangelism, Lessons on Evangelism from C.S. Lewis. Mm. And really heartening days, actually, helping people work out how they engage in this kind of world where people are drawn in by conspiracy theories and people have questions about sexuality. And just a mixture of, you have to buy the book and read it, some really good lessons, but some very practical tips of, for example, how you just dial down the temperature in some of these conversations.
For example?
So how you face the same way. So he said people often ask him about sexuality and gender issues. And he says his standard response is, I see where you're coming from, but what you need to understand is actually Christianity has always been on the wrong side of the gender debate, or on sexuality debate. Mm. And actually, you know, back in Bible times, someone had their head chopped off for daring to suggest that someone couldn't sleep with their sister-in-law. Mm. So actually just to tone down the temperature and say, yep, I can see what you're saying. Actually, Christianity's always been like this. Mm. And actually, some of those little tips just for conversations I found really, really both fascinating and helpful. So, a great book. I'll do a review of it at some point.
Fantastic. And you were with Dr. Stetzer, I think, as well.
Yes, so Midlands Gospel Partnership this week. I had a hug from Ed Stetzer.
John, how are you feeling about hearing that news?
He really wanted to give John the hug, and he said he would give it to me vicariously as long as I passed it on.
If you don't know what we're talking about here, you just need to look. There is a meme, I think, that does the rounds of John and Ed Stetzer hugging on the stage at Hemsby at one of our leaders' conferences. Helpful time?
Well, a very helpful time. And just a couple of, I mean, he's a great observer of the Christian world, Ed Stetzer. And,
globally, actually.
Globally, yeah. Yes, and historically as well. And one of the things I really valued, he was talking about sort of our theology of mission post-COVID world. And he said, actually, when you look at the 20th century, especially in the 21st century, you look at traumas that have happened, First World War, Second World War, you know, these kind of traumas that happen in the world. What tends to happen is it takes 6 to 8 years to bounce back. For the evangelical church to be back where it was, doing the things it was doing. Now, he said that the world's more condensed now. It's kind of concentrated down. But even so, thinking that COVID is over 6 months ago and suddenly we're all back to normal, he said it's just completely unrealistic historically. Mm. And he said, actually, that there's a sense in which it's very disheartening hearing 6 to 8 years to get back to where we were. But on the other hand, it's very liberating because people are thinking, well, actually, you know, we should be back to where we were by now. And what's going wrong? So to hear, actually, it just takes a lot longer than that for many people is both encouraging, but actually helps you to see that the qualities that are really needed are resilience, are patience. You just keep going with the same old stuff. So I found that a really helpful insight. I think many of us are far too bullish about how quickly, as churches, we could get back to doing normal stuff. And we're discovering that certainly at the fringes of church life, that's just not true.
John, where have you been? You've been on the road as well.
I was at a meeting about evangelism. I attended a sort of gathering for church leaders in London that was organised by a group called Leading the Way, which is the ministry of Dr. Michael Youssef, who is an Egyptian-born evangelist working in America. In honesty, I'd never heard of Michael Youssef before I got the invitation. I didn't really quite know what I was going to. I discovered that he was trained at Moore College in Australia. Mm. He was mentored by John Stott in his kind of ministry. And he's had a sort of very sort of high profile, particularly television ministry through the States and around the world. He's planning on thinking of some events and ways of getting the gospel out more widely. So this was just a chance to get church leaders together to think about this. But the primary focus was thinking about our context for evangelism in the UK in the light of the post-COVID situation. We were talking a few moments ago about the kind of people sort of believing conspiracy theories. And I think that it's absolutely right. People suppress the truth of the gospel, and it requires the power of God and the Spirit of God to open blind eyes to believe. But at the same time, as we preach the gospel, it's absolutely vital that we engage with our context and that we're context appropriate, but also that we have confidence in the gospel message and proclaim it faithfully. And both of those things were being stressed. I found it really helpful. There was an excellent kind of little session from Amy Yore Ewing, who was basically talking about our context in the UK as we move out of postmodernism, actually people desperately looking for purpose and kind of meaning, and how we can speak the really good news of the gospel kind of into sort of that context. I think she helpfully showed that a lot of what's going on with sort of intersectionality, critical race theory, etc., is a deep rage that people have for justice. Mm. And the gospel connects with that and provides for it in a way that the sort of secular society simply can't. So I think that was a real encouragement. A real encouragement to preach the gospel in its fullness, and you know, call people to repentance and faith. That proclamation of the good news of the Lord Jesus is what is absolutely sort of essential. One leader sort of in a sense emphasized that we live in this tension between longing for more, longing for revival, longing for breakout, and yet having to also work in the moment. That you can't sit there just simply hoping for revival to come and do nothing. Mm. So how do we manage that tension of longing for more plus ministering where we are? And actually for me, R.T. Kendall, who was minister of Westminster Chapel and a former past president of FIEC, just gave literally 5 minutes at the end about what he thought about the state of the church and why we're where they are. And it was sort of gold dust in a sense. He simply was saying to a group of leaders, you know, pastors, do you pray? And was sort of saying, you know, actually one of the real problems in ministry at the moment is pastors not praying. He said the kind of the average is pastors spend no more than 4 minutes a day praying on average was the figure he quoted. And he was encouraging us to pray. He said Luther prayed 2 hours a day, three hours when it was a particularly busy day.
Yeah.
Kind of Wesley kind of did the same. So he said, do you read God's word for yourself? And he was pointing out so many pastors do not read the Bible other than for preparing a sermon. They're actually not being fed on God's word themselves. And then the third point, which I thought was really telling, said, are you preaching eternal punishment? I was making clear that actually the gospel is all about the rescue from eternal punishment and hell. And he actually said, loads of evangelists simply don't even believe in eternal punishment, let alone preach it. And is it any wonder we're not seeing gospel progress?
There's nothing to be saved from, is there?
Yeah, if we don't preach that. Yeah.
And he was saying, actually, you know, you look back at the great revivals of history, and it's that message of the eternal punishment that was being preached by people like Wesley, White, Whitfield, and others. And I just thought those were really insightful and very challenging comments that were being made about what we need to do if we want to be effective in evangelism.
And thinking about evangelism, we look forward to Andy Pattison's sermon at the Leaders Conference. He'll be looking
the corner.
Yeah,
Phil.
Absolutely, to fire us up for evangelism in that. So if you've not booked yet, you still can. Bookings close at the end of the month. So do go to the website, fic.org.uk/LC2022 to book your place. And we look forward to seeing some of you in Blackpool. John, Adrian, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
It's been good to talk about the news. This has been Independence, the FIU podcast, and we'll talk to you again soon. Do rate and leave us a review so others can find it. We'll speak to you again soon. Thank you.